Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to StrategyPage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of StrategyPage.com, your host. Today we'll be talking to Austin Bay and Al Nofi. Austin Bay is an author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Al Nofi is a military analyst, military historian, and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Welcome, Al and Austin. It's about time for us to kick World War I off. We've been setting the table for it 100 years ago. What day do people say that the war actually started, Al?
Well, there's been this tendency, like this year, the big day was August 4th, which is odd in a way since declarations of war had already been exchanged between Germany and Russia. And Germany had already, of course, invaded Luxembourg, and Austria had already attacked Serbia. But 11 p.m. London time on August 4th was when the British ultimatum to Germany expired. And that, I think, has sort of become the symbol of this becoming a global war, even though Germany was already invading, you know, France and Belgium, and Austria was already on the offensive in Serbia, and the Russians were probing into East Prussia. That, for some reason, is the traditional date, although the first shots were actually fired on July 28th.
Correct. That was with the invasion in Serbia, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, that's one of those odd things, because the Austrians shelled Belgrade, and that was it for the next couple of weeks. And it wasn't until much later that they actually started to invade. Meanwhile, of course, there was fighting everywhere else. So the empire, incompetent to the last, so to speak, if they had perhaps sent a couple of corps over the border to grab Belgrade, which had already been evacuated, the Serbs had no intention of defending it. It might have actually changed the whole the whole war. If they grabbed Belgrade and then said, okay, now we'll negotiate, well, it might have been hard for Russia to say, well, we're going to go to war anyway, you know. But hard to tell what these guys were thinking sometimes.
Dan,
yeah,
let me...
Austin.
I like Al, I'm sometimes slightly amused about the debate of when it starts. It's kind of sounds like an Anglophile or British bias to make it in early August, or when the British ultimatum expires. But World War I begins really on July 28th, 1940.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, my Creator Syndicate column, which we run in On Point, was called the July Crisis. And that is really the July Crisis of 1914. And the Serbs, the Austrians declare war on the Serbs, double-crossing. And Al could actually talk about this, Germany, or surprising Germany might be a way to put it, surprising them rather than, that's the right word, by making that declaration, and it is 1 month to the day after the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. But that's when it starts. Now,
yes.
Al's point, could Austria had made that decision, was ready to exploit it, and gone and grabbed Belgrade and said, now we've taken this, and we've made our point, and we've attacked this terrorist Serb regime. Could you have stopped the increasingly... could you have stopped the mobilization? Could you stop the shooting? Maybe you could have. I mean, it's an alternative history, but it's a very interesting point. I'll be quiet because I know we got to get the guns of August.
Guns of August.
All right.
where do we start with the guns of August? Well, probably we have to start in 1871. Germany is clearly the most powerful military nation on the continent, having just humbled France. France is occupied, a big chunk of France, something like a quarter of France is occupied there's a crushing indemnity imposed on the French, an indemnity that was actually far greater than the one the Allies imposed on Germany, proportional to the economies of the time. And the French managed to pay it off in 3 or 4 years, which frightens the Germans. And then the French, meanwhile, begin, you know, because they have to evacuate, and the French begin to rebuild their armed forces, and the Germans begin to wonder about, well, what's going to happen next? So in 1875, Bismarck sort of provokes a little crisis just to test the waters and see what people would be, you know, see if the other powers would be receptive to a preventive war by Germany against, you know, rebuilding France. And it turned out that the British and the Russians and even the Austrians were not happy about that proposal. And so the question became, what do we do if it does come down to a war with France in the longer run? And there are two paths here. Now, Bismarck, of course, is going to take a diplomatic path and start to build a series of alliances that initially include Russia and Austria, and then extend to Italy, but then they lose Russia. And Moltke, he's got the problem of, if there is a war, how do you fight it? And he begins to plan for a two-front war in the mid-1870s. Just in case, you know, we have to fight Russia as well as France. You never know. And he postulated that France would probably take a defensive stance. Now, he was right about this because his espionage told him that the French deployment was basically a contingency plan. The French were concentrated in two or three areas so that whichever direction the Germans attacked, they would be able to jump and counterattack. So he figured he'd put about half the army in the west, most of it covering the French frontier, but with two corps on the defensive on the Dutch, Belgian, and Luxembourg frontiers in case the French tried to then run. And the rest of the army would be about 9 corps, would go against Russia, although he didn't expect he could defeat Russia. What he expected was kick the Russians in the teeth a couple of times, let them fall back on their, you know, deep defensive line, and then just turn around and try for the French again. So we get these alliances, and by 1888, Germany has a secret military convention with Italy and Austria-Hungary, which actually, this is a clever move on Bismarck's part, since Italy's biggest enemy is France, followed by Austria. So what Italy is worried about is being attacked by Austria and no one to help. So Bismarck brings Italy into an alliance and basically says to Austria, you're not going to attack Italy. And in return for this, Italy commits to put troops on the Rhine, which will strengthen the German army. And this is a secret agreement. And this is the beginning of a lot of secret agreements, which are a problem because the governments don't even know about them in most cases. In some cases, the general staffs are the only ones who know about it, not even the war ministry, which is, like, really weird. So we go along, and Moltke is still relying on Bismarck. Moltke feels that we should not go to war. The best we can do in a two-front war situation is try for a long a protracted war against Russia and defend against France and see what happens with Russia. But he much prefers diplomacy to avoid further war. And arguably, Bismarck sees Germany as a satisfied power in Europe, so Bismarck wants that too. Moltke retires as chief of the general staff about 1890 or so. And Waldersee was appointed. Waldersee thought it was a good idea to avoid a two-front war, too, But he developed war plans anyway, just in case, you know. And his idea was that in bad weather, which of course means mostly winter and the rainy season in Russia, in bad weather, the bulk of the army, 17 corps, would try and invade France. In good weather, the bulk of the army, about a third of the army would actually attack Russia, while the rest of the army would defend against France. And if Russia was sufficiently defeated or beaten back to the line of beaten back to the Pripyat marshes, so that's about 200 miles, 150 miles inside Russia, then they could turn around and take on France. But Waldersee's tenure as chief of the general staff runs into several snags. First of all, there's a fellow named Wilhelm. And, of course, Wilhelm fires Bismarck, and that begins the disintegration of the German safety net, so to speak, diplomatic safety net. But Waldersee does other things. For example, he criticizes the Kaiser's desire to build a big navy, which is really bad. And he's also perceived as meddling in politics, in other words. But arguably, the worst thing that happened was that in the autumn of 1891, during the annual maneuvers, the Kaiser was commanding one side and Waldersee was commanding the other, and Waldersee made a big mistake. He won. And he was demoted to corps command, and his place was taken by Alfred von Schlieffen, the alleged genius who is going to do so much to cause the war. Von Schlieffen's genius extended to making sure that the Kaiser never lost the maneuvers again. So that tells us something, you know. He came into office, of course, with sort of the Waldersee, you know, Russia first if we can plan, and which was also Moltke's plan. He doesn't think it's possible to do much against Russia. Even if the Russians do retreat, abandon, you know, Poland and Belarus, sort of to the line of Brest-Litovsk, he figured if the Russians did that, they would just be involved in a war of attrition, because the Russians weren't going to quit. There'd be this huge area to occupy, and they'd still have the French to deal with. And they apparently war gamed this repeatedly, this solution was confirmed. The trouble is that German general staff war gaming was sometimes not up to snuff. It's hard to tell. Now, the basic strategic problem of a war between France and Germany is that their mutual frontier was only 150 miles long. I mean, that's what the border of Alsace-Lorraine, you know, was. And the southern part of that frontier ran through the Vosges Mountains, and there were elaborate French fortifications behind the frontier at Verdun and Toul, Epinal and Belfort. There wasn't much maneuvering room. In 1893, Schlieffen tried a plan that would involve an attack into the 50-mile gap between Epinal and Toul, and that didn't work. They war gamed that out, and that didn't work because it ran up against the French deployment plans, Plan 7, Plan 12, and Plan 13, which had been kindly provided to them by an agent in the French railway system. And so they knew that that wasn't going to work. In 1899, Schlieffen read Hans Delbruck's account of the Battle of Cannae and decided that Cannae was the way to go. He figured if Hannibal could encircle a much stronger Roman army with an inferior force, why couldn't he pull the same stunt against the French? He overlooked, of course, the fact that while Cannae was a stunning victory, Hannibal lost the war, you know. So he begins to toy with the idea of attacking France by way of Belgium and the Netherlands, and of course Luxembourg, which is thrown in for good measure. Now, decades earlier, Bismarck had pointed out that a German invasion of Belgium or the Netherlands would immediately bring Britain into the war against them. Called it complete idiocy. Unlike some other people, he understood the British, I think, better than his successors. So in 1899, Schlieffen makes his first plan. He's going to send 4 Army Corps to watch the Russians. 9 Corps are going to deploy in Alsace-Lorraine, and the equivalent of 10 Corps are going to deploy on the Belgian-Luxembourg border and sweep into Belgium, while the French, of course, presumably are being pinned against Alsace-Lorraine. Now, this was only a slight violation of Belgian neutrality. They were going to sort of sweep into Belgium, deposit troops to defend the line of the Meuse, and envelop Verdun, and then march south to crush the French against the frontier in the forces guarding Alsace-Lorraine. French Plan 14 was in force at the time, so he thought he could pull this off. And he didn't think the Belgians would be a problem because their army was particularly bad. In fact, the Belgian army was particularly bad throughout the 19th century. So he figured, he might be able to pull this off. But it wasn't quite right, because if the French detected the movement too soon, they might be able to pull back. Now, one of the problems with studying the plan is that a lot of the documents were destroyed in the Second World War. So we have this problem. One particular fellow, Zuber, has postulated that, in fact, there was no such plan, that Schlieffen's plan was a vision, that never was put into practice. But that's been refuted lately, although some people still stick to it. Most scholars of the subject, including most German scholars, say there was a plan. And one of the interesting things that happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union was that many of the documents that were thought to have been destroyed were found in Moscow and brought back. And other documents were found because of the peculiar... There was no German army. I guess we should start with that. There was no German army. There was the Prussian army, the Bavarian army, the Württemberg army, and the Saxon army, which in peacetime had their own war ministries and to a certain extent had a could do things on their own. Uniform details could be different and so on, and training practices. And in wartime, they would all come together under the imperial, under the Prussian general staff. To make it even more complicated, portions of the Prussian army were somewhat autonomous. It's very complicated. Anyway, so these it turns out that some of the documents were being deposited in Munich and Dresden, for example. So now in 1905, Schlieffen develops a plan. There's going to be 23 regular army corps and 24 reserve divisions, which effectively are 6 corps. So there's 72 divisions. French only have 21 corps, about 45 divisions, and no useful reserve formations. In addition, 1905 is the aftermath of the Dreyfus Affair and the Affair of the Fiches, which is usually forgotten. The Affair of the Fiches is the anti-Dreyfus Affair, in which the anti-Dreyfus elements in the army, having gained dominance, proceed to persecute the pro-Dreyfus people, right? So, for example, anybody who went to mass too often, might put his promotions at risk and so on. So the French army was in considerable turmoil in 1905. In addition, of course, Russia was out of the picture because in 1905 they had been whipped by the Japanese. So the danger of a protracted war with Russia in 1905 is not there. Schlieffen's idea is he's going to just put 10 divisions, a seventh of the army, to keep an eye on the Russians. Eight more divisions and the Italians will go into Alsace-Lorraine. And 54 divisions would go on to his right and sweep through Belgium, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, which is often forgotten, to envelop Paris and destroy the French army. Now, this operation would start on the 16th day of mobilization, when the troops would have moved up to basically the line of the Meuse at Liège and whatnot, after Liège had fallen. And then they'd have from the 16th to the 42nd day to win the war. And the plan was extraordinarily detailed. It also was extraordinarily flawed. He assumed that the Belgians, who had six divisions, not very good, but still, nor the Dutch, with four divisions, would put up much fight. He considered that they were militia, basically, you know. That the British would not intervene, although he did make some provisions in case the British did show up. But the biggest mistake is that beginning on the 16th day of mobilization, the troops in the German right, the First Army, would have to average at least 30 kilometers a day for 4 weeks. And presumably, since we would be campaigning in the summer, which is the best time to do this, there's the heat, there's possible enemy resistance, there's a supply line that is, you know, getting longer and longer and longer. And eventually, of course, the Russians would be ready, so you had to worry about that. And of course, Schlieffen assumed that the French would adhere to their war plan, which was a defensive war plan. This is Plan 15, which actually did provide for some possible German threat from Belgium. So 1905, 1906, just as he's retiring, he writes another plan, which is actually a plea to expand the army enormously so that he would be able to do this, but Germany is not going to do that. His immediate successor is the younger Moltke, and Moltke is usually blamed for a lot of stuff, but he actually was pretty good. He actually managed to get the Kaiser to stop meddling in the maneuvers. He sort of pulled him aside one day and said, "You know, your Imperial Majesty, I mean, you and I both know that you're a great general, but you know there are some small-minded people who want to say that we let you win, and that's not really, you know, we don't really want that impression." And so the Kaiser said, "Oh yeah, that's a good point, you know." So the Kaiser usually didn't meddle in the deployments. Now Moltke, remember, it's not 1905 anymore. He becomes the chief of staff in 1906, and then it's 1907 and 1908, 1909. The Russians are recovering. The British are mending fences all over the place. As early as 1902, they've actually formed an alliance with Japan so that they can bring their navy home to cope with the Kaiser's navy. They're mending fences with the French. They're not in alliance with the French, but they're mending fences with the French, mending fences with the Russians, entering into arrangements with Italy, which has an escape clause in the Treaty of Alliance with the Britain and with Russia, with Germany and Austria, which says that under no circumstances will this treaty obligate Italy to go to war with Britain, which is, you know, if you think about it, quite logical, since Italy is extraordinarily vulnerable to maritime attack. So he also sees this. He sees this and he says, "All right, what can we do to improve on the plan? We still he still thinks knocking France out first is a good idea. And, but he's worried. The Italians are not going to show. He's convinced the Italians are not going to show on the Rhine, which makes the Rhine weaker. The army has grown to 80 divisions. Arguably, it could have been 86 divisions, but the Kaiser didn't want to authorize any more new corps because there weren't enough nobles to provide officers. What he does is he actually reduces the number of divisions in the east to about 9% of the overall force, whereas Schlieffen had put 14%. Moltke puts all of the newly formed divisions most on the left wing to cover Alsace and Lorraine because the Italians are not showing. But what he does on the right wing is very interesting. The number of divisions on the right wing doesn't change. It's exactly the same number that Schlieffen had allocated, 54 divisions. But he increases the effectiveness of the force by a couple of measures. First of all, he decides that he doesn't have to invade the Netherlands, which would require maybe four divisions to hold down the Dutch. He also decides that given the state of the Landwehr and whatnot, and the fact that the army is going to form replacement units, divisions, rather than besiege Antwerp with reserve corps, he's going to besiege them with replacements. It's a siege, right? You know, I mean, it's the Dutch. So the actual number of troops and the maneuver force is going to be better, you know. So this is the plan as it exists. Now, the problem with the plan is it still has the flaws that Schlieffen's plan had. Little Hart, whose credit, of course, has come down considerably as we learn more about some of his writings and some of his thoughts, he called the plan a conception of Napoleonic boldness. But he also said that it was a Napoleonic conception. You know, the troops are going to be marching, and that was fine in Napoleon's time. But now we have these things called railroads. And the French might not have been able to alter their dispositions radically in Napoleon's time if you're trying this sweeping moment, if you steal a march on them. But if you're marching and they're railroading, you have a bit of a problem. The flaws in the plan, well, you know, tremendous. The amazing thing about the plan is that well, to give you an idea, between August 18th and August 23rd, the German First Army marched 500 kilometers. That's astonishing. But, you know, those guys are getting tired, and their shoes are wearing out, and their uniforms are getting raggy, and they're outstripping their supply lines. There's not much motor transport. Moltke was introduced motor transport to the army, but only for ammunition trains. You know, so that was a problem. On the French side, most of their plans had been defensive, and then along comes Plan 16 was defensive and assumed large-scale German operations from through Belgium. That was thrown out because the French had decided to become offensive-minded, and Plan 17 was instituted. Now, it's still only a deployment plan. It's a contingency plan. In fact, they've got five armies. Four of them are on the frontier, one of them partially covering part of Belgium. One of them is in reserve, and the assumption of the plan is once we figure out what the Germans are doing, we will attack. The trouble is that in 1914, they attacked before they figured out what the Germans were doing. If they had waited just a few days, they might have done much better. They also did not put as much emphasis on their reserves as the Germans did, although, as it turned out, the French reserves did quite well compared to what the French thought would happen to them. And in the event, although they took a terrible beating, their casualties on August 22nd were the highest in the history of the French army. Something like 25,000 dead in one day. Just astonishing. Including Foch's son and his son-in-law. But one thing, big difference between the two is Moltke, the younger Moltke, inherited from Schlieffen the assumption that we could command the army from the rear. In fact, Schlieffen actually writes, "The modern Alexander will sit at his desk and receive telegrams and telephone calls and stuff, you know." And that's what Moltke did. He moved headquarters from Berlin to Karlsruhe and from Karlsruhe to Luxembourg. And that's where he was. He was in Luxembourg. Joffre, who probably wasn't as smart as Moltke, but he had more better instincts. First of all, he didn't trust the telephone because somebody could be on this other side taking notes, and he didn't want, you know, he didn't like that. And he also recognized the limitations of telephone and radio in those days. So he had a Grand Prix driver and a hot car. And he would travel from Corps headquarters to Corps headquarters, sometimes catching two or three of them in a day. Can you imagine, you know, speeding along the French roads of 1914 at 50 or 60 miles an hour, you know? And the difference was, for example, as they were getting towards the Battle of the Marne and the German troops on the far right are really just exhausted, they're living on whatever they can steal and wine that they can loot and whatnot, and the promise that Paris is close. He'd call up the headquarters and they say, "Oh yeah, things are fine. You know, the troops are, you know, we had some problems with the troops moving ahead and so on and so on and so on." Joffre would, you know, pop in on an army commander's headquarters and look the guy in the eye and say, "How are things?" And he would know very quickly, not just by talking and looking in the general's eye, but also as he's passing through the guy's troops. You know, what do they look like? You know, what's their spirit like? And so on. So although he bungled the beginning of the campaign, he was, you know, once he realized he bungled, he started juggling troops to the west, and you have the Battle of the Marne, which, you know, effectively changes things. The Battle of the Marne is the most decisive battle of the war. Not because it ended the war, but because it decided the war was going to go on and on and on. And now for the other folks, to say briefly what they were up to. The Austrians split their army into three parts. If they were in a war with Russia, they would send three corps against Serbia and 12 against Russia. If they were in a war only with Serbia, they would send six corps against Serbia and keep nine to watch the Russians. Even though, as the crisis unfolded, and it being clearer and clearer that the Russians were going to back the Serbs, they took their strategic reserve of three corps, and instead of throwing it against the Russian front, they threw it against the Serbs, which had disastrous results, as you can imagine. Now, they had a very confusing military situation, which I won't even attempt to go into, since they had three armies. The Russians also had two war plans. Their plan G, which was for war against Germany, presumed that the Germans would hold against France and make their main effort in the east. And so the Russian plan was very simple. They were basically abandon Poland and retreat to the Pripyat marshes so that they could complete mobilization. The full mobilization of the Russian army in 1914 required 42 days. The Germans required only 15. So that's one of the reasons why the Russians began mobilization procedures almost a week before anybody else. Their plan A assumed that Germany was going to go against France, and therefore they could go against Austria. And this is, of course, what happened in 1914. Their invasion of East Prussia was actually a diversion, intended to divert the Germans, and they blew the whole deal. The British didn't have a war plan. They were just going to put an army on the left flank of the French and see what was going to happen. And then there was an argument between the Royal Navy and the British Army as to whether the Royal Navy wanted to take the army into the Baltic and march on Berlin, which would have been interesting. They probably would have been arrested in by the Danes or something, you know. The Belgians, they had no real plan. They had three war plans. One assumed that the Germans would attack, one assumed that the French would attack, and one assumed that the British would attack. And in any case, the plan was a holding action to retire on the fortress of Antwerp and hope that the other guarantors of their neutrality would come to their rescue. Since Germany was one of the guarantors and the French and the British, this was not a good plan. The Serbian plan was to abandon the frontier zones, fall back on the interior, and then counterattack, which actually worked. And the Italian plan was, Italy actually intended to carry out its obligations, assuming there was, although they had dropped out of the, because of the Italo-Turkish War, for a time, they told the Germans and Austrians that they would probably not be able to make it. But once that was over, they began resuming planning. And the problem was that once Britain came into the picture, they weren't going to show up on the Rhine. And that was the end of that. I want to say a word about wargaming. They all did wargaming. The great Moltke had wargamed all his victories. But the general staff lost the thread of history, historical wargaming and history writing. They fell into the trap of making their conclusions fit their assumptions, which was not a good idea. Wargaming, of course, did convince them that a frontal attack into France was probably a bad idea. The assumption was partly influenced by the fact that they thought the French were going to violate Belgian neutrality as well. So they weren't exactly, they didn't quite understand what the French intended to do. In 1905, they played a flock of war games, Schlieffen's last games, and one of the games was presumed the German defensive because of simultaneous Russian and French offenses. And so in that game, oddly, Schlieffen moved most of the German forces to crush the Russians. So he kicked them back, and then made a counterattack into France once he threw back the Russians. In fact, it was remarkably like the actual Battle of Tannenberg, which had been played and replayed repeatedly. In the West, they assumed that the French invaded Belgium and that the British came in on the side of the French. This clearly shows that they're not reading the British very well. And that the Dutch went to help the Belgians. So Germany finds itself allied with Belgium and Holland. And then the war game is, you know, the troops come back from the east, and there's an improbable series of German offensives in which two massive encirclements, one in northern France, western Belgium, and one in Alsace-Lorraine, the Germans pocket both armies. That didn't work out very well. Other armies did war game pretty well. There were some interesting and curious things. The Germans assumed that the French were not very good in the offensive, which didn't work out well. Another assumption, which was very interesting, was that during all of their war games, you know, the French had these fortified zones, Paris, Toul, Epinal, Belfort. The fortified camp of Paris covered about nearly 500 square miles. That's pretty big, during their operations in the war games, the Germans would surround these sometimes. And oddly, the German players who were playing the defenders only in one game did the German player commanding the French garrison actually attempt a sortie. So the Germans convinced themselves that they didn't need to worry that much about the French fortress zones if they could bypass them and screen them. And of course, that if you think about the Battle of the Marne, that's exactly what they tried. They tried to bypass Paris, and the Paris garrison initiated an offensive, and that began the Battle of the Marne. So that was something they didn't learn from war games. And the Russians also didn't learn. Russian army had a problem. The Russian general staff was actually very good. There's a really interesting book, I think it's by Bruce Menning, who argues that the training of a Russian staff officer was at least as good as that of the German or the French. Problem was that Russian staff officers did not get the opportunities that German or French ones did, especially German staff. I mean, if you were a staff officer in the German army, your future was guaranteed. So senior commanders were very often not staff qualified. And during one of the Russian war games, they're doing an offensive into East Prussia, and the First Army is attacking from the east, and the Second Army is attacking from the south, which is exactly what happened in 1914. And it turned out that the timetable for stepping off for the French First Army developed a gap of 6 days because of the problems the Second Army had in moving up through the marshes. The Second Army didn't have a good rail connection to the frontier, so that for 6 days only the First Army would be in close contact with the Germans, which would give the Germans the opportunity to defeat the First Army and then turn on the Second. And in fact, that is somewhat what happened. No change was made to the war plan, and this is basically somewhat what happened in 1914. The Germans inflicted a reverse on the First Army, which made it fall back a bit, then suddenly shifted and overwhelmed the Second Army. So that basically was the planning, and some of the things that went wrong. Let me get what went wrong. Okay, obviously diplomacy went seriously wrong. If there had been, if Bismarck had still been around, there probably wouldn't have been a war. Of course, he would have been about 120 or so. So that's, not much help. There was a short war mentality, which was a bit of a serious problem. It's quite interesting, actually. As far as I can tell, in terms of the heads of state or government, only Franz Joseph and King Carol of Romania thought the war would be a long one. Now, Franz Josef was the only really, you know, head of state that had ever had any real field experience. And King Carol had actually been an excellent commander in the Russo-Turkish War. Of other senior military and political leaders, only Lord Kitchener seems to have, you know, he basically told, you know, on his, you know, August 5th, right, August 5th, the war has just begun. He says, we must be prepared to put armies of millions in the field and maintain them for several years. This is, he tells the cabinet. Cabinet couldn't believe him. So they granted authority to raise six more divisions. And then a couple of days later, six more, and went on and on. All of the plans were too rigid, especially the German plans. The business about no plan survives first contact with the enemy, which is attributed to a lot of people, but certainly should have been known by the Germans. Moltke repeated it, and it's sort of implied in Clausewitz. The big one, of course, is the German assumption that the troops and the horses could just march forever and ever and ever and ever. The Schlieffen plan ignored friction something fiercely. The plan put 75% of the German army on the 75% of the German troops in the west on the German right wing, all of them essentially in the front. So you had 26 corps had to find parallel routes on a front that was only about 270 miles wide. I'm sorry, 150 miles. Because advancing through Belgium, you were going to get a 150-mile front. These guys needed about 250 or 275 miles. So they were, some of them were moving on very small roads. And any little interference could create a problem. And the Belgians were good at interfering. You know, they blew up bridges, they wrecked trains, you know. So about 27 kilometers a day was required from August 17th until September 9th when the right wing was supposed to march around Paris. Meanwhile, they were humping 50 pounds of equipment. It was the summer, the lines of supply. At one point, the First Army's line of supply was based on a very small rail terminal more than 20 miles in the rear. And everything was horse transport. And there was no allowance for skirmishes and battles. And there were like flocks of these. Protracted sieges at Namur and Maubeuge and Givet, arguably at Liège. Liège held them up maybe 2 or 3 days. Still, that's 2 or 3 days. Actions, Halen, which was Belgian cavalry, defeated the Prussian cavalry. The Belgian cavalry got off their horses, and the Prussian cavalry kept charging in the face, which was funny because everybody violated their own doctrine here, you know. But a day here, a day there, and you've got there was no allowance for contingency. Friction was there, but there was no, they had no reserve, which doesn't help. There were no initiative to junior commanders. On August 22nd, when the Germans had beaten the crap out of the French in Lorraine, the commander of the German 16th Corps spots some irregularity in the French Third Army. And what's happened is one of the French corps has fallen back and exposed the flank of the southern half of the army. So the general, Bruno von Mudra, appeals to his army commander. This is the Fifth Army is commanded by the German Crown Prince, who actually was a good general. He was an idiot, but he was like his dad, you know. And the Crown Prince says, yeah, you can't do that because it would spoil the timetable, and you have to maintain contact with the unit on the right. So arguably, this threw away a chance to unhinge the French Third Army and, you know, create a problem. All right, so the Belgians are expected not to resist, and they do resist. They're not the best opponents in the world, but they do resist. The British turn up and do pretty well. The French turn out to be able to change their plans on the fly, which the Germans are not. The Russians attack sooner than the Germans thought possible. So those are the problems. Now, the funny thing about the plan is it's so wonderful to look at that I think it obsesses people. The German general staff, of course, you know, keeps blaming Moltke, who's conveniently dead. In fact, they blamed everybody who was dead for altering the plan. And, you know, and we get quotes like this. First Lieutenant Ellis Bates is attending the company officers' corps at the Army on the Army Infantry School in 1923, and he's writing on the plan. Germany's plans in the event of a two-front war were the results of years of study on the part of great soldiers, the German general staff, almost none of whom had ever, you know, smelled, you know, cordite. Now, here's the great quote. That those plans failed was not due to any unsoundness on the part of the plans, but rather due to the fact that the plans could not be carried out by the field armies.
All right, hey, Dan, we're coming up on an hour.
Whoa.
I'm going to – no, Al, it's absolutely fascinating. I'm sitting here and why don't I – because this is August 1914, and look how – you see the problem, and so we need to address it. Why don't I try rapidly to see if I can do this in 10 minutes, because I've been thinking – as Al's been talking, I've been thinking, well, I need to come in and I'll take this from an operational level.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. For all Strategy Talk listeners, today is my 63rd birthday. So there we are. Do you want me to try to do that, Dan?
Please do. Austin.
All right.
That's why
I'm going to play on a couple of things here. Now, Al brought up Liddell Hart's Napoleonic in conception, and that's the kind of to take a shot at Liddell Hart, and as Al says, we've learned a lot about him and his pseudo-scholarship. That's the kind of drama that he could get everyone would think he was a genius. Well, it is Napoleonic in conception, talking about the Schlieffen Plan, but it's moronic in applied logistics. Al's talked about that, transportation and supply. And as a result, it's demonic in execution. I just came up with those while listening to Al, by the way. Driving the troops, Al's already talked about it, attempt to race to Paris, and they're living on Farage, essentially looted food. It looks great. It looks like this huge scythe that moves through Belgium, and it's going to take Paris, and Al's already analyzed some of the operational issues with it. As he said, 75% of the strength on the right flank, and then you're trying to push them through narrow advance corridors. Moreover, you're having them walk for the most part, and I'm sorry, there are cabs in France and in Paris, and as it is true, the French managed to gather ersatz motor transport to move troops around. And around Paris, you've got in 1914, a fairly well-developed motor transport system, plus some extremely well-developed railroad systems. And so there's and if it's Napoleonic in conception, I'm sorry, we've missed the advances in transportation and supply. That's why I said moronic, and therefore demonic execution. Just drive those troops. And as Al said, you know, with his Clausewitzian reference, and I am going to get the operations with it, but all of this deals with it, the total neglect of the total effects of tactical interference. Al mentioned cutting down trees and short, sharp actions that slow you down. If you've heard this before with the Battle of the Bulge, I know, which is 1944, guess what? That is what happens, and that is what Clausewitz means by when you're planning an action to allow for this kind of for friction, and it really does not. 27 kilometers a day with that kind of pack, plus an enemy that's trying to stop you. Now, Battle of the Frontiers. Those really do begin kicking off first week first week of August. Liège, the Belgian fortress city, is an example of the true effectiveness, the brutality of heavy artillery on fortifications. Al said it held them up 2 or 3 days. Well, some of the Belgians thought that it was impregnable. Anything but when you're able to pound it with modern heavy artillery. And then the Germans, in their own, this is where they get a plus up. They're ready to move, and as soon as they can, they're in their on their really their line of departure. Now by August 21st, now that's still now after 2 weeks after moving, they're moving to the Ardennes. The French and their plan 17, which Al talked about, are moving up to meet the Germans. Great idea, but they think they're going to run into just German light forces. And they, with their elan and their offensive orientation as Fritz Kohr, they decide to attack what they think are German light forces moving to the Ardennes. Anything but. They run into German machine guns, and they lose their momentum is lost in a slaughter there in the Ardennes, Ardennes battle, so around August 21st, which leads to the Battle of Charleroi. Look at the Sambre River. What you see when you look where the Sambre is, that the German plan, the von Schlieffen plan, is they're going to now make their turn and go south and even southwest from Belgium into France. But the French have already responded to the they figured out now what the Germans are doing, so they've got forces that are collecting on the south side of the Sambre. The Germans succeed in breaking through there. They defeat the BEF at Mons on August 23rd. Major battles. What happens is that there's a huge fortress complex that the French have, and Al, I never pronounce this correctly, Maubeuge, I know it's in northern France, huge fortress Maubeuge. Zone, yes, and it's left to rot. They go around it. Now there's the retreat to Paris in 1st Marne, and ultimately 5 through 12 September, which Al said quite eloquently, it's decisive because it's not decisive. Now we're off into this very, very long war. Now, that's my quick operational sketch of the West and the tactical components that are missed. French, Al mentioned that really the cavalry battle that the Belgians fought at Helene. This works. This is actually pretty big in Belgian views of the war. That occurs on August 12th, and it does slow them up. It slows that German advance up, which again is predicated on what I call a moronic understanding, transportation and supply, and the demonic idea that I'm going to drive my soldiers, no matter what kind of shape they're in, 27 Ks a day. And that's they've slowed them up. Now, let's go to the east. Al discussed the Russian plans. They had a defensive plan, I think G is the defensive plan, right, Al? And then the other one, yeah. the other code letter, I'm forgetting, but it was offensive. Okay. A is the offensive one, and this is the one they employ with 1st and 2nd armies. Basically, the 2nd army is headed towards Königsberg, which we now call Kaliningrad, which is the oblast of Russia, but it's the Russian zone on the Baltic. But in 1914, it was the Prussian city of Königsberg. And the Russians are suckered, really. They think that they have a very successful attack along the border. Essentially, they push back the 2nd Army pushes back the screening forces that are screening the border, and that attack starts on August 22nd. I mean, everybody can go check this out, the dates out on the web. Now, there are a couple of things that really affect what the Germans do to the Russians. They get radio intercepts, and there's some of the background on this is opaque, but if they basically are getting intercepts from a senior Russian commander of their attacking army, saying that they're going to go ahead and push forward because of their success, or perceived success, against the Germans. and the Germans let them do that, take advantage of their own railroad system in Prussia, and attack and destroy, beginning on August 26th, around Tannenberg, the Russian Second Army. And then they switch, move on the railroad, and hit the First Army. By the early September, they push the Russians back to what was the frontier, the Masurian Masurian Lakes region. On the eastern front, the Germans take great advantage of the transportation of the transportation network of electronic intelligence, and essentially one German army beats and soundly defeats two Russian armies. One other comment too on something Al said about the Russian mobilization. Russian mobilization took, Al, you said 45 days. I know, usually
42.
It's 42. Well, just like 40 to 50 days, but even at 42 days, they weren't ready. Second Army left its mobilization sites not up the full combat supply levels. They thought that they were going to get in the jump on the Germans. And again, the initial perception by Russian commanders was that the Germans were pulling back. They pushed back the border forces, covering force units. But by the time they get to 26th of August, that's just 4 days, 5 days, 6 days. But then the heavy battle that goes on in Tannenberg, they're running out of ammo, they're running out of food, and one of their corps is one of the reasons it's defeated. They were not up and they weren't carrying it with them. So there's a logistics component, an inadequate mobilization component that goes into Tannenberg. Nevertheless, that's from the German perspective is brilliant operational battle. So, Dan, that is, I left out a lot on the Western Front. I didn't even talk about Alsace and Lorraine. I'll sketch that. There's a lot of heavy stuff going on, battles on this, but I was devoted mostly to what I see to be the key elements of the German attempt to crank the flank and von Schlieffen. Al, did I leave anything out?
No, I think you got the basis. One thing we should probably reserve for another time. It occurred to me as we were talking is we've spoken a bit about cavalry, a bit about artillery and infantry and whatnot. We should expand more. For example, a recent article which essentially poked fun at these people for having cavalry. Well, you know, that wasn't as stupid as...
No, it's not. It's not. That's a good point.
Cavalry did an enormous amount of good work in 1914.
Yeah, and they don't realize that they're dealing with, in some cases, they're not cavalry with swords, even though they're the lancers and the like. You're really dealing with mounted reconnaissance troops is what you're dealing with, and skirmish troops to develop the battle.
Mobile reserves and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Well, let's do that. And this has been over an hour and 10 minutes, Dan. If strategy talk listeners have stayed with this, I'll tell you what though, Al's analysis. And about what between 45 and 50 minutes without a break, the overview that what you get from 1870, 1871 on is just solid. It was great, Al. I love listening to it. All right,
thank you.
All right. Well, next time we'll continue on.
All right.
Thank you.
Take
gentlemen.
Care, guys.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Oh wow, that was good.